Hi folks, it's Billy Fong speaking. It's so rare that I speak in English in this channel because we have an honorable guest here today, which is the former mayor of Vancouver City, Dr. Kennedy Stewart here. We're so glad to have you here, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Nice to be here. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So you're now actually like in SFU for being a director of public policy, right?
Yeah, I'm at the Center for Public Policy Research here at Simon Fraser University after, I think, 11 years in elected office. So it's, great pleasure to be here. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. It's my pleasure as well. It's always good to back to the university and enjoy the retreat to life like for a short while, like before we progress, make any progress further. So I think a lot of like Hong Kong viewers or like the people in Canada or even though like overseas Hong Kong people, they may not very familiar with the local politics in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So can we start from something softer? Like why would you, because I could observe that Dr. Kennedy Stewart having a very strong academic background, having a PhD in LSE and having a master in SFU in public policy. So that why would you alter your life trajectory from academic to politics at the very beginning?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So as you mentioned, I was originally a musician. That's how I, that's what I started as, into my 20s, and then kind of got, I enjoyed that for a while, but then became very interested in academics, especially political science. So, I took a degree at Simon Fraser in here in Vancouver in political science. And then, as you said, secured a PhD from London School of Economics, then came back to Simon Fraser to begin teaching. Always very interested in politics, always interested in cities. That was the topic of my PhD was world cities. And then in 2004, the New Democratic Party of Canada, they had selected a new leader. His name is Jack Layton, who was leader of the NDP. And I thought Jack was a very good leader. There was a seat that an opportunity opened up here in Vancouver to run for office. I ran in 2004, did well, but wasn't successful. Then really dedicated myself to my studies, became a tenured professor here at Simon Fraser in 2008. And then there was another federal election in 2011, this time with Jack Layton, decided to try it again and won. So from 2011 to 2018, I was a member of parliament for the Democratic Party of Canada, then moved to become mayor of Vancouver between 2018 and 2022. And so I've always been interested in politics. Just for me, it was always, I had a fairly poor upbringing and had seen a lot of things that disturbed me, how I think the government needed to do more for people, and that really, and studying it as an academic was one thing, but in the end, getting involved and trying to make a difference for ordinary people, low income people, was what motivated me to get into politics. It's, it's been a journey. I'm still kind of reflecting on it at this point, and still trying to do the same things I've always done, which is to help regular people, try to live better lives.
Yeah, exactly. I could still receive your email about like Forward Together campaign. Like I subscribed to the email list. Yeah.
Oh, thanks for reading.
Yeah, exactly. So I could still see your policy advocation as well as like your commitment to the community. That is very, very much respectful. Respect from the people. Yeah. So you just mentioned your tweets, like from academia to political, to real life politics. Mm-hmm. And then like after I review some of your achievement in the parliament during your terms of office, mm-hmm. there, you actually focus on scientific research. Why
yes.
would you
yep.
like jump from like social science to scientific stuff like in the parliament?
Yeah, well, that so the way the Canadian Parliament is organized is you have a prime minister and a number of ministers. You'd have a health minister, defense minister, and you often have a science minister. So this is under the Stephen Harper government. On the other side, you would have we were the official opposition, the New Democratic Party. And so you have opposition shadow ministers on the other side. And the party leader appoints you to be one of these critics, essentially. So I was appointed to be the critic for science and technology. And that's why I went from social science to much broader fighting for scientific research, especially investments in basic science. So teaching at the secondary level, elementary and secondary school levels, but also investment in scientific research and partnerships from around the world. That was because the government was busy muzzling scientists at that point. They were scientists would make all these discoveries, government scientists would, and then the prime minister and his ministers would not allow them to speak about these discoveries. So we were fighting against the muzzling of scientists and as well as trying to increase their funding. So that was really I did that for 3 or 4 years, which was great. I got to meet all kinds of scientists and help organize them to become more of a political force in Canada.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, because like the scientific research is the driving force for the country that to improve, mm-hmm. and no one should be left down like on the journey of academic research, particularly in the field of scientific mm-hmm. research and technology, because it is just building a better city for us. Yeah, really, really appreciate that. And the second thing that I would like to mention, which is about your struggle or you are actually one of the person who initiated like the online petition system on the mm-hmm. parliament in Canada. So that why would you have such thoughts at the very beginning, and what challenges or what's like good things that you have experienced during the journey you strive for this goal?
Yeah. So when I was elected to Parliament, you do things as a political party, but you also can take actions as an individual member of Parliament. I am very committed to democracy. That is something I've studied for my whole academic career and been very active in it. And a lot of times we focus on elections, but I was interested in public participation in between elections. At the local level, you have this all the time. People participate in cities in between elections, but at the federal level, that hardly happens at all. You really have very little ability to influence federal government policy. One way we do this, and it's a long tradition, is through petitioning, is that you get names, signatures on a petition, and then the government responds to you in some way. So I thought it would be good to modernize the system and make it electronic petitioning, meaning you don't have to sign a paper petition. You can actually go online and sign. This, I borrowed a lot of it from the United Kingdom. They had brought in a system of electronic petitioning there. So I brought this in as a private member, but under my own power to do this, triggered a vote in the House of Commons. And surprisingly, I won. It wasn't something that anybody was expecting. And it was the only vote in the House of Commons during that 4 years that Stephen Harper actually lost. I managed to convince some conservatives to come and vote with me and to pass this. So now if you go on the House of Commons website, you're able to start a petition and you're able to send it around the country and get signatures. And if you get over a certain threshold of signatures, the government has to respond to whatever you're asking for. They may not give it to you, but at least they have to say why. What they're going to do and respond to your demands.
Yeah, exactly. Like for example, during the administration of Barack Obama, mm-hmm. and even for now, like you have mentioned, like the Parliament in the UK, they also have like the online petition system. Mm-hmm. But there was a critics about like online petition system is that like, oh, if the government or the people in power would be very embarrassed, like if a lot of people are yearning for something that is obviously go against the authority's will. So, mm-hmm. so like, what do you think about that?
Well, that's what democracy is. Being somebody that ran a city for 4 years, you know, there's many difficult decisions you have to make. You don't always agree with them, but you're not a dictatorship. You're not an authoritarian regime. You need to respond to what the public wants. And even if you don't do what the public wants, you have to explain to people why you're not going to do it. So if you lose that, you lose what it is to be a democracy. So my feeling was when I brought this in is that, you know, Canada is a good democracy. I think, you know, our elections are free and fair, but we can do a lot more in between elections. And I was really happy to get the support from my own NDP colleagues, from the Liberal Party, as well as the Conservative Party. So, you know, and I did that all the way through my term as an MP, is try to work across the aisles, try to be less partisan, and to get more things done. So, for example, I became very good friends with Michael Chong, who is a Conservative. We actually wrote a book together. I supported his efforts to reform Parliament and make it more democratic. And he supported my efforts. So through those efforts, we've had a good friendship and cooperated on lots of other issues as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because the involvement in politics is not about the time, the second that you fall, but like in your real life that you are exercising your freedom and democratic value, even yeah. though we are in a daily life, that's very important. Like, mm-hmm. since you mentioned about like you have achieved a lot, like particularly like a friendship relationship, bipartisan values and democratic values in mm-hmm. the parliaments. Do you have any like a very impressive moment like in the parliament that we have achieved it? You have achieved it, so that you would like to share to our peoples in Hong Kong?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've actually, you know, watched Hong Kong over the years. You know, I was in the UK when the handover occurred. I think it was 1999, right? And just the worry everyone had, where you went from a city that was, you know, a part of a democratic tradition, and we were all worried about what was going to happen as you transitioned after the handover. And unfortunately, you know, we've seen a real decline in democracy. And I think that must be incredibly difficult for people that have lived in a democratic regime to no longer have those freedoms to speak, to talk to governments, you know, in between elections, and in fact, risk punishment if you do so. So, you know, I think it's something that we all watched, we dreaded, and now we stand with Hong Kong and those who would like to increase democracy in that very, very important part of the country, part of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Like, therefore there was like a very welcoming like immigration scheme for mm-hmm. for the Hong Kongers that in Canada that welcoming yep. Hong Kong people going to Canada to pursue not only like not only life but democracy and like uphold the value of justice and democracy here as well. Mm-hmm. This is very much appreciated. And then like can we some of the we can talk more about like on your life in municipal city like mm-hmm. in the city of Vancouver, so that you just maybe in the parliament you make grand policy, but when it is in municipal level like on the in your term during your terms of office as mayor of the Vancouver mm-hmm. city, so have you ever encountered like some challenge or some like a moment that you really feel like it's very rewarding that because our efforts pays off, something like that?
Well, you know, my term as mayor from 2018 to 2022, the first year was kind of unremarkable, 2019, but then of course we got into COVID. And that was an extremely stressful period. I talked to mayors from cities all around the world during that period. National governments in some ways were not acting quickly enough. And so what we were seeing in cities all around the world was cities were actually taking the lead. Mayors and councils were shutting down, trying to get protective equipment for their population of frontline workers. There wasn't much that municipalities could do about vaccines, for example, but we had a lot to do with physical distancing and lockdowns, and making sure that supply chains stayed open as much as we could to make sure people were, you know, could stay as healthy as we could. So that was, you know, what was really interesting in that point is that when you're a mayor, you often bypass national conflicts. So, you know, and that's been a long history of big cities, is that even if the heads of governments are not getting along at the national level, mayors can talk to each other and try to share information that would help the citizens of both areas. So, you know, that has been a long tradition of municipal leaders, and that's something that really happened through the COVID pandemic, is that mayors all around the world were sharing information, because a lot of it, I mean, I don't really like thinking about the beginning of COVID. It was so difficult for so many people, but the information we were getting from, you know, I don't think we spoke to anybody from Hong Kong, but we were definitely speaking to mayors from Japanese and Korean cities, definitely from Taiwan, and then Italy and all across Europe. So I mean, that exchange of information, and especially, and what we were always worried about was that, you know, what is what we're hearing true? Because there was a lot of, you know, political spin going on, sometimes out of the United States, sometimes out of other countries. And so what I really liked about the municipal level was, you know, we were so busy, you know, we're mayors of Italian cities were dealing with mass death very early on. And so we were all trying to get factual information to each other. And that, so I know it's not a happy moment, but I think in the end, that so many cities came through COVID, I think, better than we may have if we hadn't cooperated, for me, is a highlight of my 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. That was during the pandemic. I was in Singapore by that time. Yeah. So everyone get locked down, like, mm-hmm. because Singapore has used it to be a very very strict country, like people. Yep. Walking on the street, like if they are found, like, oh, you're too far away from your home doing grocery shopping, they would be right. Fined, something like that. But we could tell not only people in Singapore, like even people in Canada, Vancouver, mm-hmm. like all around the world, they are suffering from the pandemic because they have to face a lockdown situation. So, but I think, like, as you have mentioned, like the municipal level, like we on municipal level, like different mayors all over the globe, they can share information, they can mm-hmm. share their practices, they can share their experience together. So how to offer the immediate support to the citizen here, because like municipal level, like it is the very, very frontier, like that.
Yeah, people you're on the front lines. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'm so grateful to have you during that period.
Well, and also, you know, COVID was a real challenge to democracy. It's very extreme to have to tell residents of a city that they have to stay home, that they can't travel, they can't cross borders. And we're seeing the repercussions of that, you know, from COVID-19, the lockdowns and things in Canada. We had a trucker's convoy in Ottawa that really shut that city down. There's a lot of defiance and there's a lot of anger still from a lot of it is from misinformation, which is, I think, still challenging to our democracy. And we all have to kind of come together and remember what our core values are. And they are equality and justice, which is best recognized through a democratic system.
Yeah, exactly. Like I for this time, I would like to mention Thomas Hobbes, but I better stop here because you are the real expert. Yeah, exactly. Like I would like to also ask some question about like your policies during your terms of office as a mayor of Vancouver City. Like I think like there when I'm now in SFU Waterfront, that branch, yeah. Like Bellsprout Library. I'm now in here, so that like maybe two blocks away, there is like Hastings Street. So that mm-hmm. people overdose, people homeless people, they gather there. So that like, what do you think about this situation, and what did you do to alleviate such situation here in Vancouver, so that we can know more about your efforts in this aspect?
Yeah, I think like all big cities, you know, they're wonderful places to be for many people, but for many people, they're the worst places to be. So you see in Vancouver, but lots of other cities, every city around the world, you have folks that are living without homes. They're living rough or sleeping outside on the streets. And many also, because of that or other reasons, turn to drugs to help them cope. Usually both those circumstances are usually caused by trauma. People are traumatized by things that happen in their family, or things that happen at their employment, or abuse, or all kinds of reasons. And so the downtown east side in Vancouver has always been one of the parts of Canada that is, you know, sees a higher level of homelessness and drug use. So through my term as mayor for 4 years, I really tried to address these two things. I worked with the federal government to get the largest investment in social housing in the history of the city, brought in over $1 billion in social housing investment. And so that built, you know, homes so for people could get off the street and could get into modest but very secure accommodations, and also to get, you know, services that are often attached to that housing. The other was, I think, a fairly controversial thing, which was, you know, the reason we have a big spike in people that are dying from toxic drugs. People that were drug users in the past were quite certain of what was in their drugs, but now they've all been poisoned by fentanyl, essentially. Nobody really knows what they're taking. They're still addicted to drugs. They're still living with addiction. So they take these drugs, and they're often the drugs, the dosages are much too high, and they overdose and die, to the point where one person a day is dying here in Vancouver. Although the national and provincial governments do some things, they put out advertising campaigns, they distribute naloxone or Narcan to help when somebody's overdosed, they're really not curbing the deaths. They're still, you know, this has been going on now since 2016, and it's spreading across Canada. So one effort I put in place, and this is really because the police started to agree, the police and the public health issues, that arresting people is not really helping them. To come across somebody with drugs, arresting them, taking the drugs away, putting them in jail, they're not getting proper medical attention. They come out of jail after a short period of time, and then they go right back to using. So I led an effort here in the city of Vancouver to decriminalize drugs. That is that the police no longer would have the authority, if they found somebody with small amounts of drugs, to arrest them or seize their drugs. And the hope is there is that these folks, instead of going to jail, will seek medical attention. So these are various programs to either help them completely become drug-free, or to better manage their drug use through the help of doctors in the medical community. So that we were successful in achieving that. That I didn't think that would happen, but we did manage to achieve that here in British Columbia. And now we're in a 3-year trial project, trial program, to see if we can, if this will help save lives and improve lives. So actually, I've written a book about this that I've just published called Decrim, How We Decriminalize Drugs in British Columbia. And it's really a manual that if this is something that interests you, you can learn more about it for wherever you're living. And also, you know, what it took in order to get this policy passed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. The reason why I asked this question, because I received an email on this book.
Ah, all right. Okay. Well, I hope you read it.
Exactly. Adding on that, like, I would like to ask a question that maybe my mom would ask you.
Sure.
So my mom, like, because my mom is a very Asian people person.
Oh, okay.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. She would like, oh, like, if you allow people having a small amount of drugs in their pocket, isn't it an in the other way around? It's an encouragement for them to take drugs in this sense. Like, how could I answer my mom?
Yeah,
please help me with that.
You know, I think you have to start with what you're seeing. You know, and it's a very scary topic for many people. To be fair, you know, I've had a family member myself die from poison drugs. And when you talk to people in Vancouver, many, many, many people have, or really across Canada now, they've had a family member pass away. And you have to think, well, this is happening to so many families, not just here, but in the United States, all around the world. And so you start with the idea is that we have to have fewer people die. And that means you have to understand how this actually works for somebody. Like, you definitely tell people to stay away from drugs as much as you can. But when they start using drugs, it's very, very difficult for them to stop using. And I think that So if people are very supported, if they're wealthy, they can go to treatment programs. But even people that go to treatment programs, 90% of them fail. So there is this kind of myth out there that, you know, that if you just get somebody into a treatment program, they will get off of drugs and they'll live a happy life. But in 90% of the cases, that's not true. And so you have people that live for their whole lives using drugs. They often can live very productive drugs. However, because drugs are illegal and because they get arrested, these folks are criminalized and they're forced farther and farther and farther into the margins and away from the kind of treatment and help that they need to maybe not get off of drugs, but to stabilize their health. And this is a very hard thing for people to come to terms with. For example, your mother would say, well, but if your mother was, or others, many, many others are faced with these kind of choices, well, this person is never going to get off of drugs. First, you have to understand that. And then you think, well, they're using drugs that are poisoned. And they're buying them from organized crime. So this is putting a lot of money into the pockets of criminals. Banning drugs hasn't worked. Drugs have been illegal forever. It hasn't worked. So we have to try something new. And so what the police and the doctors are telling us is, this is, again, the police have written official national reports saying we needed to decriminalize drugs. So if you trust the police and you trust the doctors that we have to try something new, that's what I did. And that's why I pushed for what I supported, what they were pushing for. But we also have to have treatment for people. We also have to have housing. We also have to have, healthy food. But we do realize that folks will be using drugs for probably most of their lives. It's just that they will decrease the dose that they use and they will be able to stabilize. So in the end, it becomes a much more manageable disease. It becomes more like diabetes or high blood pressure. It's something, you know, it's serious and it comes under different circumstances, but helping folks who use drugs stabilize, be more productive and happy is all our end goals should be. It should not be punishment because these folks have suffered enough. You know, it is. And if we look at who uses drugs, it's often marginalized communities. So Indigenous people in Canada, you know, in Vancouver, even though there's only about 5% of the population is Indigenous, about almost half of the homeless population are Indigenous people. And that's because we committed genocide here in Canada. People don't like to talk about this, but we tore Indigenous kids from their families. We put them in residential schools. We tortured them. We abused them. We murdered them in many cases. And then we just said, well, you know, sorry about that. And we're going to move on. But this isn't the case. So what happens when you go through that type of trauma? Can you imagine, you know, when I talk to my mom, can you imagine if I was taken from you as a baby and you never saw me again? And then if you did see me, I couldn't speak the language anymore. Like, it would be so traumatic. And so we have to take the advice of our healthcare officials and police, say we cannot traumatize these folks anymore. We have to help them. And unfortunately, it's going to mean that we're doing things that we're uncomfortable with, and decriminalizing drugs is one of those things.
Yeah, but we cannot only focus on like the decriminalized drugs in a very separative angle. It's like, because it's a collective effort, collective measures that to help people get rid of this slippery slope of drug addicts. So I think it is like a part of, to me, at least for me, it's a transitional policy. Like we are moving towards the end point that we could get rid of that and having.
I don't think you're ever going to get rid of it. I don't ever think you're going to get rid of drug use. I mean, national surveys say that almost 18% of Canadians have tried hard drugs.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people, right? And there's a reason why they're doing it, is because there's trauma. So, I mean, it's, you know, we think about hard drugs with decriminalization, but alcoholism is even a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
And we know when we banned alcohol, nothing stopped. People just You know, we tried that. So you have to realize when what you're doing is not working, and you have to try something new, even though it might be scary to try.
Yep, exactly. So can I give my last bit of the questions?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
which is about like, probably a lot of Hong Kong people have heard of Dr. Kennedy Stewart in his, because he had a meeting with CSIS, and then like he initiated to forge a friendship relationship with Kao Xiong, and being criticized mm-hmm. by the Chinese embassy, and mm-hmm. then like during your elections, so yep. there is like a rumors about like a China interference, something like that. Mm-hmm. Can you share something like your experience or your thoughts on these issues with us?
Yeah, the election that I participated in 2018 was very different than the election in 2022. Something my campaign manager, my team, and I realized that something was different in the 2022 election. There was so much social media traffic that was against me. Huge spikes of social media attacks, essentially, that there's nothing I could do to counter it. But then I lost the election, and I moved on and went back to academia. But shortly after the election, just before the election, about 3 or 4 months before the election, CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, contacted me and warned me that there was a potential for interference in local politics in Vancouver, but couldn't be specific about what was happening. What could I do? I just went on and kept being mayor, and then went into the election. But after the election, after I lost the election in the spring of 2023, the Globe and Mail contacted me and said they had received transcripts from wiretaps of the local consul general. And there were discussions between my political opponents and the consul general, whether it was the consul general or their staff, basically talking about how to get rid of me because of my activism, because of my support for Taiwan, and because of my democratic advocacy. I had also had refused to speak to the consul general after there were threats made to my friend Michael Chong from the Chinese government. And and I'd gone to many kind of pro-Taiwan events and am close to that community. We after the Globe and Mail, you know, I went on the record talking about this. I don't have a lot of direct evidence myself, but CSIS apparently does. However, none of this information is being disclosed. There is a national investigation of federal elections, but not local, which was extremely disappointing. I did push to have these included. I talked to all federal parties to say, look, we have to look at, even though, you know, I concede that I lost by a large margin, so, I may not have won the election if there was an interference, but we should all be worried if there is foreign interference in our elections. And since that time, over the last few months, more and more information has come to my attention that this is a big problem. And in fact, you know, you might even call Vancouver a gateway city to North America. There is, my concern is that there is a, my concern is that there, this is seen as a weak link in North America, where it is very easy to influence local politics, secure positions at the local level, and then move up to the provincial or federal level as elected officials or people within parties or organizations to influence our national level policy. And, I was really hoping that the federal inquiry would get into this. That being said, we're still going to get much more information about interference in federal elections, which seems to come out every few days. To me, this is an extremely serious problem. I mean, as I said, COVID has had a tough effect on people's belief in democracy as it is. But if we allow foreign interference to in our election cycles or politics in between elections, it is. I mean, we're at risk at having our democracy deteriorate, and that is that's probably the most important thing about being Canadian is living in a democracy.
Yeah, exactly. That's right, because we have the same values and we exercise the practice of the democracy and freedom here, so that we are here to like living happily. So there's our fundamental values here.
And I could see in Hong Kong, you know, for people who have lived in a democracy and then have it disappear, how painful that would be, and then how tough it is to get it back. How tough it is to emerge as a new democracy is very difficult. You know, we have to fight every day to, you know, somebody told me once, democracy is like washing dishes. You have to do it every day. And so, as you said, I'll continue to do this. I have some things I'm working on now that I'm happy to talk to you about in the future, but have enjoyed in talking to you today about this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you. So good to have you today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.